So today, like I said, we're looking at Exodus 28 and 29. These chapters discuss the clothing and the consecration of the priests. Remember back in 25, it started the tabernacle instructions with the most important thing, the Ark of the Covenant. And then it talked about the menorah and the table of showbread. So basically the three most important pieces of furniture, starting with the most important, the Ark. And then it talked about in the next chapter what would house all of that. So what would house the Ark of the Covenant? What type of a building is worthy to be a place for God's footstool to be inside of? And we talked about all of the glory and the imagery happening there. And then we talked about the outer court that would surround the tabernacle and kind of separate it off from the camp because it is directly in the middle of the camp. And at the end of that section, it talked about the oil for the menorah. So it basically kind of answers a hanging question of, okay, how do we light this all? Because you got a lot of covering on there. And then it also serves as a perfect segue into these chapters today, chapters 28 and 29, of who is going to work inside of what we just built and maintain it and officiate inside of it. And how do they need to be set apart in order to be able to serve there? Because we talked about the last couple weeks of how there is a vast amount of work and very purposeful nature to how everything is built, how everything is set up. So one would expect that the priests, even down to their clothing, are also going to have a lot of precise instructions, and that's exactly what we're about to see. As we look to these two chapters, like I said, chapter 28 is the clothing. That's pretty much the entire context of that whole chapter. And then 29 describes the process of consecration for the priests, and then also talks about some of the regular offerings that they will give. The consecration process and the regular offerings are actually things that we already talked about last year in Leviticus. If you read 29, specifically 29, 1 through 37, and then flip over to Leviticus 8 and 9, they are almost word for word. So this might feel like a little bit of a cop-out, but I am actually not going to cover chapter 29. Because we already covered it last year. So if you're curious about all that, you can go back to the Leviticus sermons and listen to that. Well, the other reason I want to do that is not only not to be a little redundant, but also because I really want to focus on chapter 28. And I know that seems weird. I want to focus on clothing, but you will see why. There is so much in the high priest clothing and the priest clothing that I was a little baffled at times in my study because I'm like, okay, what strand do I pick up on? So you'll see that at the end, I kind of chose two or three, but just know that there is even more. There are more layers of what's going on. There's more connections that can be made. Literally everything about what is being said has some sort of biblical theology that you can trace going forward. And I'll also point out, though, what details you should maybe not be distracted by, because there's a lot of uncertainty about it, or it's just kind of part of a building picture, and you should be focusing on the bigger picture and not too fine into the details. So we'll talk about some of that. But for today, again, we're going to be focusing on chapter 28. So as we look at chapter 28, basically 1 through 5 serves as the introduction to the clothing. So 28, 1 through 5 says, "Then bring near to you Aaron, your brother, and his sons with him, from among the people of Israel, to serve me as priests, Aaron and Aaron's sons, Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar. And you shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother, for glory and for beauty. You shall speak to all the skillful, whom I have filled with the spirit of skill, that they may make Aaron's garments to consecrate him for my priesthood. These are the garments that they shall make: a breastpiece, an ephod, a robe, a coat of checkerwork, a turban, and a sash. They shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother and his sons to serve me as priests. They shall receive gold, blue, purple, and scarlet yarns in fine twined linen." So these verses, especially 2 through 5, introduce the whole subject of the clothing. Their clothing, just like them, due to their office, their clothing is to be holy, set apart, and their clothing is going to be made with skill of the same material, notice, of the tent. Especially the inner layer. We're going to see a lot of connections between the inside of the tent and especially the clothing of the high priest. So just as the tabernacle was set apart and made from special materials, so also the clothing of those who serve there is going to be set apart and made from the same special materials. we're going to see this as we work through the text, that especially the clothing of the high priest, and we'll even talk about kind of when he wears this stuff, but we're going to see that his clothing has a very prominent amount of gold. Because remember, last week we talked about you walked into the tabernacle and you're surrounded by this framework of gold. And you have gold rings and gold bars, and then you have this very ornate inner curtain that you see. So kind of keep that image in mind as we work through the clothing of the high priest. And you're going to see a lot of similarity, and that's not an accident at all. If you're curious, by the way, as you read or looked at that list of all the clothing that they wear, notice that there is footwear not mentioned. There's a reason for that. Remember back on the mountain when Moses had seen God and God said, take off your shoes for the ground on which you stand is holy? Same idea here. They are serving and officiating on holy ground. So they do not wear shoes as they officiate. So that's why footwear is not mentioned anywhere in this chapter. The first article of clothing to be discussed is the ephod. As we begin to work through the clothing, you will notice that the main focus of this chapter is on the clothing of the high priest. The clothing of the normal priests isn't explicitly mentioned until all the way down in verse 40. The reason for this is that here, as elsewhere, the most important things are listed first. And the normal priests actually wear four of the articles of clothing that the high priest wears. So by the time you finish describing the high priest's clothing, you have described the other priest's clothing. So basically what you'll see at the very end there is basically just specifies which of the articles the priests wear. So you have the differentiation between the high priest and the normal priests. The first, or I need to specify this because last week we started inside out. This week we're going to start outside in. So the first, which is actually going to be the outermost layer of clothing for the high priest, the first layer is the ephod. And these first two articles of clothing actually make up the first layer. So there's the ephod, and then we're going to talk about the breast piece. They're connected, and we'll see that as we work through it. The ephod, what this is exactly, and why this week, like the last couple weeks, I do not have a picture, is that there's actually a lot of uncertainty of what exactly the ephod looked like. There are many different strands of Jewish tradition, and part of the reason is that a lot of how we picture the ephod and really a lot of the high priest clothing, a lot of how we picture it actually comes from Second Temple times, so like around the time of Christ or even later, when you have detailed accounts that give specific anecdotes about what exactly a high priest at a certain time looked like. That's where we get a lot of those pictures from. And the problem is that during the course of that of time, there may or may not have been alterations and slight changes in what exactly was worn. So we kind of have to take that all with a grain of salt. So there is a lot of uncertainty about what the ephod looked like. And in fact, that's true about, honestly, many of the details and terms in this chapter. A lot of it's not perfectly understood. And if you look at different sources, which I kind of just did as a fun exercise, I looked at a bunch of different study Bibles and even websites, just kind of find pictures of what the high priest and the priest look like. They all look different. So again, I'm focusing on the general idea of what is happening and the message that's being given through it. The ephod, by the way, specifically, if you do look at pictures, it's pictured in various ways. Sometimes it's a sort of waistcoat, like a fancy waistcoat, or a pinafore, which is sort of like an apron. And then it could also, like some places even pictured as like, it's a weird way of describing it, but like a skirt with suspenders, basically, like, or more a kilt, if you want to use that word, with suspenders, because it mentions shoulder pieces. So you have to have something going over the shoulders, but then some sources understand it, the ephod is waist down. So there's a lot of variance of how it is pictured. Luckily, exactly what it looked like isn't the point. So if you lose days just trying to track that down, I would argue that it's going to be interesting. You're going to run into a lot of interesting things. But that's not the main point. So we're going to focus on what's being taught through it. Notice first that it is made of the same five visible materials as the inside of the tabernacle. So starting in verse 6, they shall make the ephod of gold, blue, and purple, and scarlet yarns, and of fine twined linen. So gold, which this is an ephod, this is something that's worn. So this gold would have been hammered gold that was then cut into threads and then woven in with all of these linens and the fine linen thread. And then the blue, purple, and scarlet, and then the fine twined linen. All of those, including the gold, are the exact same materials that are seen and prominent on the innermost layer of the tent when you walk in, and then you got all the gold bars. So basically what you've done with the ephod is you've taken those five materials and transform them into something that somebody can wear. You'll notice, again, this pattern throughout much of the high priest's clothing. Just as the materials used throughout the tabernacle complex indicate spheres of proximity to the Ark of the Covenant, basically the material changes as you get closer. You start from the outer courtyard, that outer fence, and you work in. The materials are going to get fancier and more expensive. And so you get a lot of gold and a lot of really expensive stuff when you get really close to the Ark of the Covenant, to the Holy of Holies. And you're going to see this exactly with the high priest's clothing and then his difference between him and the other priests. He matches the inside. And then when you look at the other priest's clothing that we'll get to at the end, they match the courtyard. And they match where their primary duties are. The high priest primarily has his duties that he's known for as inside the tent. And then the normal priests, their primary duties fall outside in the courtyard. So their clothing matches in exact correlation to where they are serving, which is just kind of cool, noticing the perfect parallel between even the clothing and the materials of the tent and the courtyard. In fact, it seems that the high priest wore the most decorative pieces. So this piece here, the ephod, and going forward, we're going to see other pieces that match the inside of the tent as well. It seems that he only wore these most decorative pieces when specifically he went in and out of the tent. When he was serving in the courtyard, it actually seems that he took them off. And then when he went into the tent, he put on the articles of clothing that matched where he was going. So I think that's even really cool. There's so much purposeful imagery that is happening here. In fact, it seems that he was, like I mentioned before, he was kind of a human-sized replica of the inside of the tabernacle that walked in and out, only wearing the appropriate things at the appropriate times. So in a way, he kind of brought the tabernacle in and out, and the people caught a glimpse of it as he walked. Because one thing you need to remember with all this, because we read all these details about the inside of the tent, we read all these details about the high priest, and we visualize them, we have pictures of them. One, the people didn't all have a copy of this. Like, they saw it being built. But then once it was built, people never saw the inside of the tent. So the only glimpse that most people had of the inside of the tent was the clothing of the high priest that in a way matched the inside of the tent and brought it out to them briefly. Because again, he only probably put it on when he's coming in and out. So they caught brief glimpses of the tabernacle. And what's also really cool about it is, so you think about that, he's bringing the tabernacle in and out, kind of they're catching brief glimpses of it. But more importantly, as we'll see, work through the materials and the stones and everything, he brings the people in through his representation and through the stones, and that's what we're about to work into. So I think that's, you got to keep that concept in your head as we work through this, that the high priest serves as kind of this mediator, as this representative of the people that moves in and out and brings them in, gives them a glimpse of the tabernacle, but more importantly, he brings them into the tabernacle, into the presence of God. And this is all pictured through his clothing. By the way, the fact that the gold is mentioned first is likely because it is the most valuable, but also is probably because it was the most prominent. The ephod would likely have had would have been likely metallic and heavy. So this gold that was hammered gold, cut into threads, and woven into the other materials would have likely been kind of the base or the most prominent one. Some texts throughout the rest of the Bible seem to indicate that this ephod, especially with the breast piece attached to it, was metallic and heavy enough where it could stand on its own. So as you visualize it, like we think of this kind of flowing robe thing, which like kind of there was a material, like a robe aspect to it, but it was very metallic. So think more of like suit of armor. The ephod and the breastpiece together, especially, and we'll get into even more metal as we keep going, but all of this together would have had the appearance of a decorative set of armor. The high priest serves, as we discussed last week, in God's war tent. So it's interesting that his clothing has the appearance of a decorative set of armor for the one who walks in and out of the war tent of the general of God. His weapons, if you will, in his service are prayer, service to God, and teaching the people. So this warrior wearing decorative armor, he isn't one who's out fighting. He's one who's representing God to the people, being their mediator, praying for them, and serving God and teaching them. This is starting to sound an awful lot like Ephesians 6, where in our armor of God, our weapons are the Word of God and prayer. As we continue to work through the clothing, there was a stone set on each shoulder piece of the ephod and enclosed in settings of gold filigree. So basically a stone set, one on each shoulder, and then it's enclosed and seated in fancy gold filigree around it. These stones, by the way, are usually translated as onyx. In fact, I only was able to find one translation that did not translate onyx. But there has been some recent scholarly work that has pinpointed probably a better understanding of this stone as carnelian. However, there are varying understandings because, again, it's all based on like the origin of the word, and we're not 100% sure. So onyx could be what is meant. It could be lapis lazuli, I think is how you say that one. It could be emerald, or what seems to be more likely is a carnelian stone. But either way, the names of the 12 sons of Jacob were inscribed on these stones, six on each stone. The word here used that they were inscribed like one would inscribe on a signet or a seal is an Egyptian loanword. And this is because a industry of miniature engraving was in Egypt and present, and we have historical record of it, as early as the 16th century. So this is a well-known form of artwork, and they did miniature engraving on the stones. The 12 names, by the way, so you have six names on each shoulder. It is specified that they are the 12 sons. What's interesting there is if you catch that, and then you read forward to the breast piece that has the 12 individual stones with individual names, it seems that the ephod here, the two stones, had six names of the sons, like the literal sons. But then the stones had the tribes. So it seems that there's likely difference. It's a little bit unclear based on the wording, but that's how usually it's understood. So you then likely have both the literal 12 sons and then also the 12 tribes that resulted from the choices of those sons being worn by the high priest as the stones of remembrance. And if you aren't familiar with the difference, there's the 12 sons, so like the 12 literal descendants of Jacob, but then the 12 tribes, if you follow along with those, Levi is not mentioned in the 12 tribes because Levi is the priestly tribe that doesn't have its own tribal allotment of land. And then also Joseph's name is not in there, which took me a while to understand growing up because I'm like, I just feel like he gets gypped. He doesn't get his own tribe. He actually gets two. He gets a double portion because of his personal history. There's a lot of Genesis is due to him and his faithfulness. So he actually gets a double portion. And then, again, Levi is not mentioned. So you have, and the double portion, by the way, is Jacob, or Joseph, thank you, Joseph's two sons. So like that's the difference there. You have those 12 tribes probably on the breast piece, and then you have the 12 sons on the shoulders. So all that to say, the high priest is likely bringing into the tabernacle to God as the stones of remembrance, he bears the names and the history of Israel into the tent. I think that might be why there are two different sets of names. He not only has the literal descent, but also the tribes, which kind of represent the history of the people. He's bringing that before God, not only as a remembrance to himself, which if you're a Jew, especially that close to a lot of that tribal stuff, you realize there's probably a call for some humility there in your remembrance of the history of your own people. But then it's also a call for God to remember his covenant to them throughout all of this. So that is the ephod. The next piece is the breast piece of judgment. And this next article of clothing, which based on your translation, you're going to see either breast piece of judgment or breast piece of decision. And this begins, by the way, in verse 15 and goes through verse 30. The breast piece, describe it simply, it was basically a pouch of about 9 inches square, so 9 inches each way, worn over the chest, so basically front and center right here. And then it had 12 gemstones on the front, each engraved with one of the tribes. And then it also had the Urim and Thummim, and there's like four different ways to pronounce that, so I'm sorry if I didn't pronounce it the way you're used to. I'm not even sure if I did it right. But it had the two stones, or actually we're not even sure what they are, honestly. It had the Urim and the Thummim inside it. And what's fun about this one is, first, I had to realize studying it that it's actually not solid metal. It's made of the same stuff as the rest of it, so it's like a metallic-y thing, but it's a pouch because it's doubled over. And then it has 12 stones on it, And nobody's sure exactly what all the stones are. There's a lot of debate about them. Three of them, the only times we see the name of the stone is here and then another text that repeats here. And none of these stones have any explanation given. So we're not 100% certain what exactly all the 12 stones are. And then we're not exactly 100% sure what the Urim and the Thummim are. Because we, throughout the Bible, they're mentioned, but their description's never mentioned. Their precise manner of use is never mentioned. And then even the meaning of the terms is never mentioned. Like if those words, there's one word on each one, or if there's like a yes or a no on each one, we're not sure. It seems like it's similar to casting lots, potentially. That kind of comes from a time that Saul uses them to help determine who was at fault, and it ends up being that his son was at fault. So there's a lot of uncertainty about this. But again, long story short is that it is a pouch that has the 12 stones of the 12 tribes. So that's one of the main purposes, is the stones of remembrance, the 12 tribes, the history of the people. But then it also holds a method of gaining divine counsel and divine will. And that's what the Urim and the Thummim are used throughout the Bible for. So that's why it's actually called the breastpiece of judgment or decision, is because of what's inside of it. So sorry, there's a lot of uncertainty there. But those are the first two pieces, the ephod and the breastpiece. And long story short, what to remember with them is, again, what they're made of. So the fact that they match the inside of the tabernacle. And then, honestly, one of the most important things is that they hold the stones of remembrance with the two different versions of the names of the tribes. So kind of remember their general appearance and also their purpose. And that's the most important thing to remember going forward. The next thing is the robe. And this is in verses 31 to 35. And if you start in verse 31, it says, "You shall make a robe of the ephod, all of blue." And the English is fun there, because there's like robe of the ephod. What does that mean? Basically, it's a robe worn under the ephod. There's a lot of debate about what all parts of the body the robe covered. The most common understanding seems to be that it was a sleeveless robe that went down to almost ankle length. Not 100% sure on that one, though. And then also the word for blue, I didn't bring this up last week, but it's more accurate to probably think of it closer to a violet. So if you're trying to picture this as you go, picture more of like a violet hue to the robe. But this robe was worn underneath the ephod and the breastpiece as the high priest, and it was made entirely of this blue or violet tint. And this blue, violet, however you want to think of it, remember that this is the most expensive type of material here, most expensive type of thread. Obviously, the gold's more important and more expensive, but this is now like a pure thread material. So the blue violet is the most expensive one, and the only other time that this is the only color that is visible on something is when the Ark of the Covenant is being transported. It has this blue violet curtain on top when it's being transported. It's the only object within the entire tabernacle to have that blue on top, or that violet, as it's being transported. This connection, as the high priest wears this in and out of the tent, and then also thinking about it, the fact that the Ark of the Covenant is the only other place that you see this, I think this also has a bit of foreshadowing of something to come. The Ark, the seat of God's presence, will one day move out of the tent through the work of a high priest. I think there's the purposeful connection there between those two. So just kind of keep that nugget in mind as we keep going forward. In some of your translations, verse 32, if you read that, it says, "It shall have an opening for the head of the middle of it with woven binding around the opening, like the opening of a garment." And mine has a footnote right there, because a lot of translations, when you read that there in 32, it's going to say it looked like the collar of a warrior, or like the opening of a coat of mail, I think some translations say. And the only thing I want to point out there is you have yet another connection to the high priest as a warrior going in and out of God's tent. So I think it's kind of cool you have kind of just nuggets dropped there along the way. And then in verses 33 to 35, they describe the pomegranates and the golden bells. The pomegranates were made of blue, purple, and scarlet yarn. So basically on the bottom of this all blue robe, you have attached to it pomegranates made of blue, purple, and scarlet yarn, and then bells of gold. What's interesting is the word translated between. So like typically we picture this as pomegranates of blue, purple, scarlet yarn, and then a bell, and then a pomegranate, and then a bell. The word between can also be translated inside. So it might be that you have all those materials with the bell inside. We're not 100% sure. But the purpose of the bells is not completely certain. It seems most likely, though, that it is an application of the common convention at the time that a subject not appear suddenly or unceremoniously. In other words, that a subject does not appear flippantly and carelessly before royalty. So the purpose of the bells is basically to announce entrance and departure. I think that's probably the best way to understand the purpose of the bells. I know that there is a tradition of understanding, and honestly, like, what I mostly grew up with was the understanding that the bells were for when he went into the Holy of Holies on the Day of Atonement, and they knew if he died because the bells stopped ringing, and then they could pull him out. The problem is that if you look at Leviticus 16, he's not wearing this robe on the Day of Atonement. He's only wearing the other four articles of clothing that go under it. So I had to kind of burst my own bubble with that, and sorry if I burst some of your bubbles as well. But on the Day of Atonement, he's not wearing this, so that's not what's going on there. There is a branch of tradition, though, that thinks that because a lot of times he's the only one that goes into the holy place, that there might be that meaning there. So if he's in the holy place by himself and they stop hearing the bells, they should probably be worried. There's even a strand of tradition that has a rope attached to him so they can pull him out. None of that's in the Bible explicitly. There's never a rope mentioned in the Bible. So like a lot of that's just kind of may or may not have ever been true at one point. But I would argue the best understanding of the bells would be this association with purposeful and thoughtful entrance into the presence of royalty. I think that's probably the best association with the bells. And then as we move forward through the clothing, you have in verses 36 to 38, you have, this one's fun because there's all sorts of different translations of it, frontlet, plate, rosette, medallion, you might have other words out there. But the general idea is that this is like an ornamental headband. This word is used in parallel in other places of the Bible with like crown or diadem. So it is associated with royalty, and it is in some way some sort of ornamental headband. And on it was engraved, "Holy to the Lord." This headband seemed to have marked the high priest as the one accountable for and representative of everything consecrated to God. The next article of clothing, it's actually a series of three. In verse 39, you have kind of rapid-fire succession for the next three. It says, "You shall weave the collar and checkerwork of fine linen, then you shall make a turban of fine linen, and you shall make a sash embroidered with needlework." The coat, or, see, look at verse 39 at the beginning, weave a coat and checker weave. Most of your translations probably have tunic. That's a better way to understand it. So it's basically an ankle-length white tunic that is worn under the blue robe. So you have multiple layers that are going on here. And then the turban of the high priest, which was also white, seems to have been different than the turban of the normal priest because it's actually a different Hebrew word that is used. And it also seems that the frontlet could be detached. So when we read that the frontlet was attached with a blue cord, which again, the symbolism of blue there, but the frontlet was attached in a way that it apparently could be detached because the frontlet is not listed on the articles of clothing that the high priest wears into the Holy of Holies on the Day of Atonement. On the Day of Atonement, he's only wearing the turban, he's wearing the white linen tunic, and then he's wearing the sash, which we'll get to in a minute, and then he's also wearing the undergarments because of decency. So those are the only things he's wearing on the Day of Atonement. And then the sash that girded the tunic is specified later. We actually don't get all these details here, but later in 39, it's specified that it matches the screens at the entrance to the courtyard and the tent, being of fine twisted linen, purple, blue, and crimson yarn, and embroidered with needlework. Its description is the exact same description that we get for the curtain going into the tent, and also for the curtain going into the courtyard itself. Which is, again, when you look at the clothing of the priests, the normal priests, in the next few verses, what you have listed very briefly is that they wear simply the tunics, the sashes, and the caps. So they wear white with a sash that matches the curtains. So they exactly match the courtyard, which is the white linen hangings that have a screen, or a gate, if you will, made of the material of their sash. So they exactly match the courtyard. And then when the high priest steps into the tabernacle, he exactly matches it as he walks in. And then verse 42, like I mentioned with the articles on the Day of Atonement, mentions the linen undergarments kind of as an afterthought, just to say that like they were decent, and then also that they honored Exodus 20, the command there that nakedness not be exposed. So that one's kind of given brief as a footnote at the end there. And then, like I mentioned with 29, so you get to end of 28, and then 29 talks about the process for consecrating the priests to serve. That's something we talked about last year, so I'm actually going to skip all the way into verse 43. And at the end of chapter 29, verses 43 to 46, give a pause, in a way. They provide a pause in the instructions that kind of gives a reminder of the whole purpose of all of this. Because by the time you get to the end of this, I mean, you've worked through furniture, you've worked through curtains, you've worked through woodwork, you've worked through all sorts of like random utensils, and then now the clothing of the priests, and then consecration of the priests. And I think God is aware that like, okay, let's remember what this is all about. So we have a pause here in 43 to 46 that talks about the point, and then immediately following this, if you're curious and you're looking forward already, you probably see the headings in your Bible. In chapter 30, it gives a few last instructions of specific things that need yet to be built or covered. There are reasons that they come next. We'll cover that next week. There's a reason that some furniture that you, like, why wasn't that mentioned earlier? There's a reason that it's mentioned next. And then in 31, describes the appointment of the construction personnel, and then also gives a closing command about the Sabbath, which we've talked about before and we'll talk about again next week. In this pause here, though, at the end of 29, God summarizes the instructions as the building of a place where he will meet with the people and a place that will be made holy by his presence. As you look at the end of 29, starting in 43, there I will meet with the people of Israel, and it shall be sanctified by my glory. I will consecrate the tent of meeting and the altar. Aaron and also his sons I will consecrate to serve me as priests. I will dwell among the people of Israel and will be their God. And they shall know that I am the Lord their God, who brought them out of the land of Egypt, that I might dwell among them. I am the Lord their God. He is reminding them and pausing, kind of almost a breath of fresh air, especially for us reading this. It's like so much detail. The whole point of all of this is that God is building a place where he will meet with the people. This place must be consecrated and set apart, and so must also the people who serve there, because it is ultimately a place that God seeks to dwell, to be in their midst, to be with them. He is setting up a place where the people will know and constantly be reminded that he is the Lord, that he is the Lord who cared enough about them to deliver them out of Egypt and make a way to dwell in the very middle of their camp. That's the type of God he is. All of this is being done because God is restoring Eden. He is advancing his plan to dwell with man. So I love the power of this closing here at the end of chapter 29. But as we think back through all the clothing, you may be thinking to yourself, so setting apart Aaron and his sons, giving them fancy clothing, how does this advance God's plan? And then if you didn't catch it already and kind of have the question in your mind, so we just set apart a family as priests. But think about Exodus 19, we just set apart the whole nation as a kingdom of priests. So now within a kingdom of priests, we've set apart a priesthood within priests. So like, what? No, it seems to be like layers or something going on. Like, what is happening? Let's go back to 28:1. And you're going to see real quickly why I had Hebrews 7 read. So 28:1. I want to consider a couple questions. First, and this may seem like a strange and an obvious question, but I think it's important to consider. Why is Moses the one to consecrate Aaron and his sons? Remember that until now, Moses has been the one who has acted as the chief officiant of offerings and ceremonies. But he is now passing on this role to Aaron and his sons. This role then is being split off from Moses, becoming its own distinct role. This brings Exodus 4 back to mind, when Moses asked God to send somebody else, and Moses said that he would send Aaron with Moses to be his mouthpiece and speak for him. The two brothers then became co-leaders, a splitting of roles. These co-leaders will now have separate roles, Aaron as the high priest, and Moses as the prophet and leader, or king in a way, though God is the ultimate king. Noticing this split of Moses' role is a key, and there's a lot going on in Hebrews chapter 7. I'm not going to get to all of it, but it's one of the keys to unlocking what is happening in Hebrews 7. And all this talk about Melchizedek. Because Hebrews 7 has a discussion about how Jesus is a greater high priest after the order of Melchizedek, who was a king and priest. The author of Hebrews is justifying how Jesus could be described as a priest. In fact, the high priest who fulfilled the priestly role in sacrifices by offering himself as a greater perfect sacrifice. How could he do this? How could he be a priest, especially the high priest, if he is not descended from Aaron? If you read in Hebrews 7, he reminds us that, look, Moses never talked about a priest coming from Aaron. Not coming from Aaron. Moses talked about the fact that Aaron and his sons have this forever. So what the author of Hebrews has to do is justify, okay, how on earth does this work? Jesus was of the tribe of Judah, not Levi. Jesus was of the tribe of Judah, but he was and is the one who fulfilled Psalm 110 and is a priest after the order of Melchizedek. That is, he is a king from the kingly line of Judah and a priest, just like Melchizedek was a king and priest. Melchizedek is an explicit example of something that was true until the time of Moses and Aaron. Genesis 1 gives a kingly role to Adam and the commands to subdue and have dominion. And then in Genesis 2, it gives him a priestly role with the commands to guard and keep, the very same words used for the priests. The patriarchs also fulfilled both kingly and priestly roles in their lives, both as leaders and priests, and so did Moses. Because again, up till this point, Moses has been the one functioning as the priest. It was not until Moses that these roles were split. And then finally, in Jesus, they are reunited. Second, these chapters, in fact, if you just look at the verse immediately before, chapter 28:1, the verse immediately before says, Aaron and his sons shall tend from morning to evening before the Lord, shall be a statute forever to be observed throughout their generations by the people of Israel. So in 27:21 and 28:43 and in 1 Chronicles 23:13, they all make clear that Aaron and his sons were to be set apart forever and that the ceremonies and offerings that they observed were to be done forever. How do we reconcile this with the rest of Scripture? How do we reconcile this with Colossians 2:17 and Hebrews 10:1, both of which say that the offering ceremonies and festivals, essentially everything that the high priest and the priests did and officiated, were all but a shadow of what was to come? Again, Hebrews 7 and also 10, there we find an answer. Here we read that Christ, because he was a greater high priest after the order of Melchizedek, a rejoining of the roles back to the way of Adam, he set aside and did away with the old laws and the old covenant and brought in a new one. Forever, then, in this context, means continually until their purpose is fulfilled by someone greater. The priesthood advances God's plan through what it made possible at the time, but also through the picture that it gave of what was to come. The appointment of Aaron as the high priest split the roles of king and priest apart, but it actually also pictured their future rejoining. I talked about how his clothing had warrior associations, but it also had royal and even divine associations. The ornamentation of clothing with gold and precious stones. There's a reason I focused on that throughout our description of the clothing of the high priest as we went through. This has a precedent in the culture of the time. It was the way that clothing was designed and put on images of deities and also used for ceremonial clothing of kings. So this clothing then was associated with an image of a god and of royalty. Think about that. This clothing that was associated with royalty and divinity being an image of God, and here, through the high priest in the Israelite religion, this person who wore this clothing that in this culture is associated with royalty and divinity being a son of a god, this person is the person who wears the clothing to represent the people and bring sacrifices on their behalf. But on the Day of Atonement, why? Why on the Day of Atonement does the high priest, the one who is wearing this clothing that represents somebody who is royal and divine, who is bringing sacrifices on behalf of the people, on the Day of Atonement, on the day that symbolizes a cleansing and forgiveness for a whole year, why does he not wear the clothing with associations with royalty and divinity? I think he doesn't do it because it is a picture that somebody else later is going to do it even better. I think he doesn't wear the clothing associated with royalty and divinity because there is a royal divine Son of God coming who will give a greater sacrifice on a greater Day of Atonement. There is even another association with the clothing. The high priest's clothing doesn't just point to Jesus, it even points to the church. The frontlet or the ornamental headband was associated with vice regency at this time. A vice regent, also known as an image bearer, is one who is granted the office of kingship and exercises authority under the authority, support, and protection of a deity or a king. Vice regency at this time was the result of a royal grant treaty, where a supreme royal grants the office of kingship to one under them. This royal grant treaty is actually what we see back in Exodus 19, where the people are called a kingdom of priests. Immediately before this verse that he calls them a kingdom of priests, God reminds them, all the earth is mine. He is the supreme ruler. He is the one enacting a royal grant treaty and giving authority and power to exercise authority to the people of Israel. To be not just a kingdom of kings, though, to be a kingdom of priests, to be those who mediate between the world around them and God, who teach the world around them and God, who are a light to the world around them and God. They were called out of all humanity, all who, remember back in Genesis 1, all humanity is made in the image of God. But Israel is called out to be a nation of royal image bearers for the purpose of being priests, for the purpose of mediation, to be ambassadors to the world around them. Just like Israel had been called out of all the peoples, so also Aaron and his sons, but especially Aaron, are called out of all of Israel to be a royal priesthood from a kingdom of priests. Aaron then becomes a chief representative. If you follow the layers, he becomes a chief representative of what God really wants, a bigger family where all are royal and all have access into his presence. He wants all to play a priestly role. Aaron is the chief representative of the plan. All the layers point to him and what he pictures. He represents where God's plan is going. When Christ, the greater high priest, came, he inaugurated the new covenant and created a church, an even bigger family, with people called out of every nation, who again are called as a royal priesthood, as we read in 1 Peter, were also a kingdom of priests. The church, we, are said to be priests who offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Christ and have access to the Father through Christ, our high priest, and the Spirit in our hearts. We are also called to be representatives and ambassadors of God to the world around us. And one day, in the new heaven and earth, we will see his face and we will have his name on our foreheads, as we read in Revelation 22. We will have the frontlet of the high priest. In that day, we will have gone from not just having the privileges of priests that we have today, the priest of the believer, we will in that day have the privileges of high priests, living in the very presence of God, seeing him face to face. Through even the clothes of the priests, God is picturing his unfolding glorious plan. Dear Lord, I thank you for this text. I thank you for the care that you put into the whole Old Covenant system, this visual Bible that you were giving, how everything was so real and needed and helpful and good then, but pointed to something even better that we have now, and how even what we have now is but a taste and a picture of what is coming. I thank you for your care for your creation. I thank you that you long to dwell with us and that you have been advancing your plan despite every opposition. And I pray that we would give thanks to you for where we find ourselves on this plan, that we would realize that we are, again, a kingdom of priests, that we are to be ambassadors to the world around us, that you've given us derivative, that you've given us granted royal status, but for the purpose of being priests to those around us. And I pray that we don't forget that. I pray that we would fulfill the mission that you have given us to be ambassadors, to be lights, to be salt in this world. I pray all this in your name. Amen.